Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Oh, hi! If you're looking for another spooky and funny podcast to add to your rotation, check out Anything Bones, now part of the Podmoth Network.
Hey, Boneheads, I'm Sophie Schwartz.
And I'm Caitlin Hart.
And we are the hosts of Anything Bones, the podcast where we talk about bones and bone-related topics.
Soph, what are bone-related topics?
Thank you for asking, Caitlin. This can be anything from mausoleums to murderers, famous skeletons to cadaver dogs.
Bone churches, mummies, serial killers. You'll hear about them all.
And sometimes we have guests stop by and tell us their favorite bony tales.
Check out Anything Bones on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, or wherever your little heart desires.
We release new episodes every Saturday.
Bone voyage.
All right, I think I hacked in.
We're on the air?
Shh, security's outside.
But how's my hair?
It's a radio station.
Psst, psst. You guys hear about the Beyond the Shadows podcast with Ryan and Scott?
You guys into paranormal?
What about true crime?
How about UFOs and cryptids?
We also have mad hauntings.
We got security.
No, we don't. We're not big enough to need it yet.
No, we got security.
Hey, what are you guys doing? Get out of here! Listen to the Beyond the Shadows podcast.
Beyond the Shadows!
Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us once again for another Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy episode.
Absolutely. Hi, everyone.
What story do you have for us today, Mom?
I am going to be telling you about a serial killer that had a recent documentary come out on Hulu, and his name is Herb Baumeister. He is a lesser known, I think, serial killer. So
interesting. I don't think I've heard that name before. So I'm excited to hear about that.
Yes. What are you going to be telling us about?
I am going to be talking about the Hindenburg.
Oh. I'd say fun, but not fun.
It's also brutal, but it was an intentional murder, so I put it at bizarre instead.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is pretty brutal. I don't know all of the details of it, so I'm looking forward to you telling us about it. Before you get into the drink, I want to do a quick shout out to podcast friends of ours, Amanda and David with One Nothing. They are back from their hiatus and super excited that they are, because they took some time off and now they're back. And so we can all go listen to that. And if anybody doesn't know, they do an amazing podcast. And so I just want to give a quick shout out for everybody to go listen to them. And I just want to say, hey guys, I'm glad you're back.
So they're always a fun group to hang out with.
Absolutely.
If you haven't, go check out our collaboration episodes with them.
Yes. Yes. So, but now that I did that, let's talk about this drink that I think is going to be gross.
Well, the name is right on the money with the story. It's called Fireball Smash. And if you don't know, both of those things are included in this story.
Yes.
So to make this, you need one part Fireball whiskey, which is, or I guess any cinnamon whiskey.
True. Yes.
But so one part Fireball whiskey, juice from half a lemon. Doesn't say what size lemon. A splash of simple syrup or cane syrup. Also doesn't say how much.
Right.
And fresh mint, either muddled or in pieces. Combine ingredients over ice in shaker, shake vigorously, and serve in a tall glass. I don't know how it can be in a tall glass because there's not much liquid in this.
Right. I had a it's little, like, the only size, like I thought I had a big bottle of Fireball and it turns out all I had was like a little tiny.
Hobo bottles?
Well, I would say like the kind you would find in a mini bar in a hotel room.
Oh, you had shooters?
I had just the little tiny, tiny baby bottles, okay. Right? The little sample bottles, if you will. And I had to use the whole thing because I was like, it needs to go in a tall glass. And then I filled up the glass with ice and it's still only half full.
Yes. It's more of like a shooter, I guess.
It is. It is.
Unless you do a lot of Fireball in there, but.
Right.
Mine's which, pretty small.
Who wants to do a lot of Fireball? Not me.
I don't know if I've ever had it before this. Like the real stuff. I've had the fake Fireball. Like.
Oh,
that you can
well,
buy at gas stations. But I don't know if I've ever had the real stuff.
Yeah, this is. I don't know how you do cinnamon whiskey with mint. Who thought that that would be a good combination? I don't know. It can't be good.
I'm trying to think of like cuisine that
cinnamon
uses
and
cinnamon
mint.
And mint, and I can't think of a single thing.
No, because they don't go together.
Yeah, it's gonna be weird. I think. Should
All
we
right,
give it a try?
Let's taste this disgusting thing. It's really weird. It's really weird. I used probably 6 mint leaves. I tore them and I muddled them. I don't think I used enough lemon juice.
Yeah, half of a lemon juice is like...
So vague.
Like half an ounce. Like, if that...
I don't know. It's not as disgusting as I thought it would be. I think
it's
the mint
weird.
Kind of
like medicine a little bit.
Yeah, the mint cuts the cinnamon flavor, like the red hot candy flavor. It kind of cuts that a little bit. But I don't think I'll finish this.
It's definitely weird. I just had to pick it because of the name.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Fireball smash that happened with the Hindenburg.
Yes.
So, in light of the 94 aircraft accidents in the first 2 months of 2025,
what?
I will be talking about one of the most infamous commercial aircraft accidents.
Wait a second. Where did you get that statistic? Because that is bonkers. Did you say
Google.
94?
94 aircraft incidents.
Worldwide?
Worldwide, just
does
this
that,
year.
Does that include like little tiny planes?
Yeah, that includes like the... one person passenger planes. There was one like last week where two of them hit into each other head on. So
good Lord. Okay.
Yeah,
that's gross. First of all, you need to stop looking up those kind of statistics.
Okay. But it's hard not to, because all I see in the news now is, oh, Delta plane flipped upside down. Passenger plane collided with Black Hawk helicopter.
I
like,
know. But we like to travel, and we can't drive to Europe, and we can't drive to Hawaii,
Yeah, but I wish we could.
I know, but okay. That's scary. All right, Hindenburg. Okay. Hopefully this so never happens Hindenburg. Again.
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't think there's the Goodyear blimp. Do they still use that?
They do use that blimp, but I think it's powered by something else.
We'll get into the Hindenburg was a lot larger than the Goodyear blimp. The Goodyear blimp was like a quarter of the size, I think.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So the Hindenburg was a German-made rigid commercial passenger blimp made by the German Zeppelin company. The Hindenburg was named after the president of Germany, Paul von Hindenburg. After a successful round-trip flight from Germany to Rio de Janeiro in 1937, the Hindenburg would debark on its fateful journey. On May 3, 1937, the Hindenburg left from Frankfurt, Germany, carrying 97 passengers, which consisted of 36 commercial passengers and 61 crew members. American Airlines had made plans with the Hindenburg to land in Lakehurst, New Jersey, and shuttle the commercial passengers to Newark, New Jersey, where they were going to hop on a flight and go wherever they were going.
Cool.
The Hindenburg was 803 feet long and 135 feet wide and was constructed of a control car similar to a captain's deck on a boat, a passenger area, 16 different gas cells that held 7.06 million cubic feet of hydrogen, which floats more than helium, to help fly the Zeppelin. Okay. And there were four propellers along the side with 1,190 horsepower engines to help prepare the aircraft. Okay. So this was a big mamma jamma filled with a lot of hydrogen.
And quite a few people.
So the Hindenburg was similar to a modern cruise ship where there were crew decks and passenger decks. So,
okay.
The bottom level of the Hindenburg featured a dining room, a lounge, a writing room, and promenades on both starboard and port side. So, they talk about it like it's a boat instead of like a
boat. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's like basically like a cruise ship in the sky.
So, how long, maybe you said this and I spaced out, but how long were the flights typically?
They would go for like weeks long because they're flying from Germany to Rio and back and like going to the U.S. Like they're going all around the country and it's made a bunch of successful flights before this incident happened.
Okay. Okay.
So the passenger rooms resembled cruise ship rooms where there were beds like on top of each other in a bunk style and they were very small. So it's pretty much just enough room for you to sleep. Change your clothes and lay down.
Gotcha.
The second floor held passenger suites, the kitchen, and the toilets with showers. So you didn't even have a toilet in your room. Which is weird, though. I wonder how they got the plumbing on that thing.
It was just a bucket. It was a fancy bucket.
They probably just had a poop chute, though. They went straight outside.
Oh, can you imagine?
This was the 37. You're just walking and a turd from the Hindenburg lands on you. It's like worse than a seagull pooping on you.
No kidding.
After a fairly regular flight across the Atlantic, the Hindenburg pulled into Lakehurst, New Jersey on May 6, 1937. There were some thunderstorms over the airport, so the pilot, Captain Max Pruss, took passengers for a ride along the New Jersey coast first before attempting his landing. At around 6:22 p.m., the Hindenburg was cleared for landing due to the thunderstorms passing. The aircraft made its way to the airport and was preparing for landing at 7 p.m. When the Hindenburg planned on landing, it would fly low and slow with several ropes down for ground crewmen to grab a hold and physically pull down the Zeppelin.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't seem very good.
And it's Just think about if, like, only one person held on and the others missed the rope. You're just flying, hanging on to a rope off this thing.
Like, yeah.
Plenty of things to go wrong.
I don't like it. How do you get that shitty really job? Intense.
Yeah. Well, they kind of started to figure it out, but... The wind speeds were fairly intense this day, and some of the ground crew were replaced with a mechanical winch to help stop the Zeppelin. So they would guide the rope onto the winch and then let mechanics stop it, which seems a lot safer.
Yeah.
So Captain Pruss fought the winds for 25 minutes, trying to make multiple entries to land, and would steer off course last second because no one was able to grab the ropes. So...
This whole rope catching thing is sketchy as shit.
And we'll see. It causes issues later, potentially.
Well, for sure. Oh, good God.
So the rope dropped from the port side of the aircraft and was attached to the winch on the... However, the starboard side was never caught. I don't know which is which.
So they only caught one side. Okay. Causing, I'm sure, it to tip a bit.
So witnesses reported seeing a small tear in the fabric of the Zeppelin and a small blue fire coming out from the tear.
No.
So like a propane, you know, propane fires are kind of like faint and like a different color than normal fire. They could see that.
Yeah. Oh.
Scientists say this could be from static electricity or St. Elmo's fire, which... I tried to look into this and it's really confusing. So if I didn't get it right, sorry, but it's a weather phenomenon that occurs when a positively charged item comes into contact with gas in an electrical field, which is, they say, was left behind from the thunderstorm because I guess it changes the electrical field of the air or something like that. I don't really know, but when gas comes in contact with that electrical field, it's called St. Elmo's fire.
Okay.
I don't know if that's correct, though, because it used a lot of big words. So this creates a buildup of luminous plasma, which may be seen as a blue flame.
Okay.
So seconds later, the Hindenburg caught flames, which ignited the hydrogen and caused the entire thing to just burn to the ground. All the gas escaped. It just, like, it wasn't necessarily an explosion, but it was... super hot, super fast. Just the whole incident lasted like 30 seconds.
Wow, that's fast.
And killed a total of 35 out of all the total passengers.
Oh.
So out of 97, about a third of them died.
I thought everyone died.
I thought so too, but there were survivors. There was people that died on the impact. There was people that died in the hospital later due to burns and stuff like that. So, a couple of people died.
Okay.
The fiery scraps of the Hindenburg were sent back to Germany, which were used in the construction of the Luftwaffe for the Nazi army. Because this is right around the time that the Nazis took over Germany. And I think, I don't really know the history of Nazi Germany that well, but I think they were a political party for a while before they started World War II.
Yeah.
But anyways, they sent what could be salvaged back to Germany to be reused. But how did the fire start? Well, it's ultimately impossible to determine exactly what started the fire. There are some different theories.
Okay, good theories.
The Zeppelin company had been receiving threats about shooting down their aircraft.
Really?
So Hugo Eckner, they didn't really specify what the threats were about, but they had reason to believe that it could have been caused by a shooting. So Hugo Eckner, the owner of the company, initially suspected that the aircraft was punctured by a shot that occurred from inside the craft.
Oh.
Yeah. Captain Pruss suspected one passenger, an acrobat named Joseph Spa. Joseph brought a German Shepherd to surprise his family with and made several unaccompanied trips to his dog, which was held in a freight room near where the initial fire started.
Okay. Did the dog survive? Joseph was also
seen... I didn't see anything about that.
Okay, so we're just going to assume the dog survived.
Dude, Schrodinger's dog, yeah.
Yep.
There's 50%
dog
chance.
Dog survived. Okay.
Joseph was seen making several anti-Nazi jokes, which was not a great sign, being that the Nazi party was the government of Germany at the time.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
There's another theory, the static spark theory. The Hindenburg was constructed in a way that didn't allow the distribution of static electricity throughout the aircraft. So when they passed through the tough weather, some of that static electricity built up in the frame of the ship. When they threw down the ropes at landing, it is speculated that when the ropes hit the ground, it caused the metal frame of the ship to become grounded, but the fabric of the ship was not grounded, causing discharge of the static electricity into the hydrogen.
Inside.
Yes. Ooh. So okay. Another theory was the incendiary paint theory. It was theorized in 1996 by a NASA scientist that paint on the fabric of the Hindenburg was the main reason for its failure. The paint used on the fabric consisted of iron oxide and aluminum impregnated cellulose acetate butyrate.
That's a lot of words.
Yeah.
Which a lot of words that I don't know what they are.
Well, I'll tell you what they are. They're okay. The key ingredients in rocket fuel and thermite.
Okay.
Yeah. So this thing was just a matchbox. Yeah, it was. Meaning that one initial flame, like once it was started, it would burn very hot and very fast, which is exactly what happened. And then the hydrogen just provided like
more
a
fuel.
Boost to the flame.
Yeah.
The site of the Hindenburg crash is at the Lakehurst Naval entity of. It's in Lakehurst. Okay.
There's
a big name. It is marked with a chain outline pad and bronze plaque where the airship's gondola landed.
Wow.
If you want to go see the crash site of the Hindenburg, go to the Lakehurst, New Jersey airport.
Wow.
I think it's a naval base that they have it on, so you might not be able to just get in and go see it, but.
My goodness.
Interesting story.
Yeah. Like, I feel like.
I think if they got the whole flying and landing thing figured out, I feel like it'd be a pretty cool experience. If it was like a cruise ship, you just.
Yeah. I was looking at some pictures when you were talking about it. Pictures of like the dining area and the rooms, and they were pretty cool looking. You were right.
It looks like an old cruise ship.
Yeah, like. It totally does. I don't know why I didn't know that it was like a long journey. Like I just thought it was they were flying it around for a couple hours. I didn't realize it was a transatlantic.
They're doing like kind of far flights.
And back in the day, I feel like they didn't know as much about science to go, should we really fill a giant balloon with flammable gas? Should we?
Not air balloons. I think that's how those work. They use gas and like flame.
Yeah, but they're heating the air inside the balloon. Like it's. They're not, although, I mean, I don't know. I've never been on a hot air balloon. I don't think the gas inside of the balloon is flammable. I think it's just, yeah.
Yeah, because hot air rises, so it probably pulls the mass of the balloon up or whatever. But
right.
Yeah, using explosive hydrogen gas as the main thing keeping you in the air is pretty sketchy.
And also painting your giant balloon with the ingredients for rocket fuel, probably not a good choice. Science is good, people. Let's focus on sciencey things. I feel like they didn't know science that well back then.
Yeah, I'm looking at the It would be really cool to go on this thing. Like,
not full of
freak me
hydrogen.
The fuck out, but like, well, if you didn't know that it was just going to blow up, it'd be a really cool trip. Yeah. Because I'm looking at the pictures of the promenade, and it's like the angled windows, so you just kind of look down over the world as you're
that
floating
would be cool.
above it.
Yeah.
The
that would be cool.
Bedrooms look a little rough, but
they're tiny. I don't like the whole bathroom situation either.
And now having a bathroom in your room is very nice.
Yeah, and a fully functioning bathroom, no less. Like you said,
I was kinda...
what's going on with the plumbing? People have to take showers.
So I'm curious if they allowed smoking, because that would
oh, for sure they did. Wrong. For sure they did. Back then, everybody was smoking everything and nobody gave a shit. They thought it was healthy to smoke. Oh, you have tuberculosis? Maybe you should have a cigarette.
It'd be like, they probably know hydrogen is flammable. They didn't expect this to happen. But if someone was smoking, then there could be very poor outcomes that I'm sure they tried to at least check on. But I also saw that the hydrogen was scented with garlic. I don't know how they did that.
Or why.
In case there was a leak, they would be able to
smell
it.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't know if hydrogen has a smell necessarily, but
it probably does when it's
garlic, so that
caught everything on fucking fire.
Yeah, true.
I feel like this should have been something that they did on MythBusters.
Yes, you're right. Like testing all the different theories.
Yeah,
like how did this happen?
I don't know if they did, but I feel like they should have.
That's a good point.
I mean, they did so much weird stuff on there. I feel like they should have. It would have been cool.
Let's see.
Live Googling on the Brutal Bizarre.
Well, they did
podcast.
Do it.
Did they?
Yeah, they've got a YouTube video.
Oh,
about it.
Cool.
The Hindenburg Mystery. I might go watch that after this.
For sure. For sure.
All right, let's hear about your story, Mom.
Okay, so here we go into my diabolical serial killer. I mentioned in the beginning that there's a new docu-series really, because it's 4 episodes and it's pretty long, but there's some interesting information in that. There's several documentaries
like,
from older.
Is it like a documentary or like a dramatization?
No, it's a documentary. Okay. But there's 4
I like
episodes.
The dramatizations more. But
sometimes they're okay, but sometimes I did.
Is
I did.
It
it's on Hulu.
Just like, oh, it's my grandma's dog's babysitter.
No.
Like, oh, he was
no.
a cool guy. I didn't
nope.
know he would kill people.
I mean,
okay.
there are a few
I
interviews,
can't stand
but
those.
Same. Those drive me insane. This one had a lot of new information that I had not heard or seen before. But the documentary is on Hulu. It's called The Fox Hollow Murders, Playground of a Serial Killer. And it is about the man Herb Baumeister. He was born April 7th, 1947 in Indianapolis, Indiana. He was the oldest of 4 children born to father Herb and mother Elizabeth. His father was a doctor, which will play a part in the story much later on. Herb's early childhood seemed fairly unremarkable, but in adolescence, he started displaying some strange behaviors that resulted in him being psychologically evaluated on multiple occasions. He eventually was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia an antisocial personality disorder. But, you know, it's the 50s. 50s and early 60s, and, you know, why treat stuff like that? Let's just find out what's wrong with him and then just ignore it. So he didn't get any psychological treatment for his diagnosis.
Seems like these diagnoses are very similar in our other stories.
Yes, for sure. I think you have to have some antisocial personality issues and some psychological distress in order to end up a serial killer. That would be my guess. Herb made a few short-lived attempts at college, but he ended up just moving between jobs. In 1971, Herb got married to Juliana Sater, who went by the name Julie. Just a few months after the marriage began, Herb was committed to a psychiatric hospital for 2 months. And the diagnosis at that time was compulsive personality disorder. So,
compulsive personality.
Compulsive. Yeah, I don't know exactly. I think that's
multiple personality disorder.
Yeah, I think compulsive is more like OCD type stuff.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But it didn't really, the source that I was looking at didn't really go into like what that was. I mean, he got treated for whatever he was in the psychiatric facility for 2 months. So, you know, there's some level of treatment there.
Yeah.
But I mean, he did go home. Julie and Herb would have 3 children together, and he was described as an involved father. You know, they did stuff together, family activities. They would go places and trips and stuff, and no big red flags or anything. In 1988, Herb started a thrift store chain in Indianapolis called Save-A-Lot. The company was successful and ended up having 2 store locations. With the success of his company, Herb bought an 18-acre farm called Fox Hollow Farm in 1991. The farm was located about 20 miles away from Indianapolis in a quiet community. It was a nice home. It was a big home. Like, if you look at the pictures of Fox Hollow Farm and you look at the description, I was trying to find like a square footage, and I finally ended up finding one. I think it was like 11,000 square foot home. Had an indoor swimming pool as well. But one of the descriptions given was a modest home. That's not a fucking modest home.
It's maybe
modest compared to like a castle. But when I think modest home, I'm like 1,500 square foot, 2,000 square foot, not 11,000.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing, but it does look modest for how large it is. It's not opulent. It's just kind of like a normal
English
house shape with
Tudor style, kind of L-shaped because there's like a garage off to the side.
It's a mother-in-law suite or whatever.
It's a big friggin' house. And it has an indoor swimming pool. I don't think you can call any house with an indoor swimming pool modest, but that's just my opinion.
They use it for wedding venues, but I have a feeling, based on the story you're going to tell us, you wouldn't want to have a wedding there.
Well, I think a certain group of people that like dark and haunted, creepy things would probably dig getting married there.
I feel like it would just be foreshadowing if you got married at a murder house. Like, that's like going to the Amityville Horror House and getting married.
Right. But
horror,
I think there's
not a horror house, but
I think there's a group of the population who would think that's cool. People that like dark macabre things would probably be like, eh.
It just seems like bad news to me.
I agree with you on that. The grounds surrounding the home were heavily wooded and serene. During the 1980s, several young men and teenage boys, many who were known to be gay and sex workers, went missing from the Indianapolis metropolitan area. Some went missing from unknown locations, while others had last been seen near or at gay bars. 11 of the missing victims during the 80s and early 90s, 11 of those missing men were found dead at different locations, all near Interstate 70. Almost all of the victims had signs of strangulation. Even though a few of the victims had been last seen with another male, police were not able to identify who it was. Law enforcement believed they had a serial killer on the loose, and he was nicknamed the I-70 Strangler. In 1991, the bodies stopped showing up near I-70, but men were still going missing from the city. In the summer of 1994, a man named Mark Goodyear had a scary experience. Now, I'm going to tell you the story, and then we'll talk about it at the end, because after watching the documentary, there are some more information and questions. So I'm going to tell you the story that was the narrative for decades.
Okay.
Okay. So Mark Goodyear was a gay man, and one of his good friends, Roger Allen Goodlett, had gone missing. There were no clues about his friend's disappearance. Mark met a man at a club about a month after his friend went missing. He had a strange feeling about how the man was looking at several missing persons posters, including the poster for Mark's missing friend, Roger. The man called himself Brian, which turned out to be a fake name. Eventually, the two agreed to leave together, with Brian explaining he was taking Mark to the home of his boss. I don't know if he was like, hey, I'm staying at my boss's house or whatever, but that's where they were going. After driving for a while, they arrived at a home, and the two men ended up by the indoor pool. The pool area was rather strange, with multiple mannequins set up around the room as if they were having a party. So there's all these mannequins posed in different places.
That's terrifying.
Right? Horrific.
What the fuck?
Awful.
I'm leaving ASAP.
For sure. So the pool area was where they ended up. There's like a bar area, some seating stuff, or it's not just like the pool in a room. There's like socialization area around it. So they're hanging out down there. The two had consensual sex, and Brian asked Mark to choke him for sexual gratification, but Mark said he would not let Brian do the same to him. He was like, I'm not into that, but if that's what you want me to do to you, all right. And according to Mark, Brian talked to him about how it was really like how he liked to look at people's faces when he was choking them and the reactions and things like that. Pretty gnarly.
Which nasty.
The investigators later were like, those are weird details, that something's fishy there. After the evening ended, Mark reported the situation to a private investigator. That's the information in a lot of the sources I looked at, was that Mark went to a private investigator, not directly to the police. And that I guess the private investigator talked to the police about it. Maybe. I don't know. Mark also explained that Brian gave him a drink at one point, and he was concerned that the drink was laced with something, so he threw it out. And he believed that Mark had assumed he drank it until he realized that Mark was not as impaired as he should be if he drank the drink. Needless to say, police were very interested in the information that Mark was describing in, that was in 94. In early 1995, Herb and Julie's son made an odd discovery while walking with a friend through the woods at Fox Hollow Farm. The son had found a skeleton and a skull partially buried. And the kid, not knowing what it was, apparently told the parents, told his mom, and his mom was like, "What the hell is that?" Herb explained the finding away, saying that the skeleton had belonged to his father and had been used for professional purposes. Because remember, Daddy was a doctor and he went to medical school. So
you can't use your own body for medical purposes when you're dead.
Dad had a skeleton for medical school, had given it to Herb.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Herb's explanation was that the skeleton had been in their garage and an animal came in, dragged the skeleton off, left it in the woods, and that's where the son found it.
Okay, sure.
Sure, exactly.
Sure.
However, taking Herb at his word, the family didn't think much about the strange finding, and within a week, the bones were gone, and nobody mentioned it to the police. Kid didn't say anything to anybody. Wife kept it, like, whatever. Okay, it's just your dad's old medical school. Sure.
Bones.
Bones, right. Almost a year after Mark had met the man, Brian, remember his fake name, with the strangulation fetish, he saw him again. This time, Mark was able to get a description of his vehicle and a license plate number, which he gave to the police. In the meantime, the police knew the information about the pool and the weird house and the mannequins, but they couldn't ever find it because Mark didn't tell them how to get there. He said it was this weird route and he explained it, but he couldn't remember. And so they never found the house. Well, now he's got a license plate number. So he tells cops, hey, this is the guy. Here's the plate number. Registration comes back to Herb Baumeister. Police confronted Herb, who, of course, denied everything. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Wasn't me. Whatever. Deny. Investigators also contacted his wife, Julie, who insisted there was no way her husband could have killed anyone, let alone been hanging out at gay bars. She was like, no, that's not my husband. Both Herb and his wife were asked, can we come and look around the property? We don't have enough for a search warrant, but will you let us search anyway? And of course, you know, they did the right thing and said no. They denied it, but again, no search warrant. Nobody's getting out there. Julie still hasn't told the cops, oh, by the way, my son found a skeleton in the woods behind our house. She just says, no, you can't come out and search it.
Detail.
Yeah. The relationship between the couple became strained and they started having, they were also having some financial issues. Julie filed for divorce in January 1996. And they soon after that, she said, hey, guess what, cops? You can come look. Have a field day. Come out to the property. Search away. She then tells the investigators about the skeleton that her son had found the year before, but of course it's gone now because her
taken moved away by animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She took them to the area in the woods where the remains had been found and police found a bone. They soon found more bones and teeth and all sorts of stuff.
That doesn't look good.
No. Some of the bones were just buried. Some had been burned. Some were very small in pieces and needing to be pieced together like a puzzle, like they'd been crushed and burned. Bad things happened to these bones. During the early stages of the investigation, four sets of remains were identified by dental records. Local law enforcement chose to look into skeletal findings further, but didn't detain Herb. So they're finding all these bones, and they're like, we just don't have enough to detain him or arrest him. Seems like nowadays that would be different.
Seems a little fishy.
Yeah. We're talking 1996. So, and, you know, again, he's a member of the community. He's a business owner. No one had anything bad to say about him except Mark Goodyear said this guy was weird, but they don't even really, you know for sure that Mark's telling the truth. They're just like, well, this guy said this weird thing happened. So they don't arrest him. Which, you know, of course, bad things happen. On July 4th, 1996, Herb's dead body was found in Canada. He had committed suicide. He left behind a 3-page suicide note. And unfortunately, he left a lot of unanswered questions because the suicide note did not mention any of the suspected crimes. None. It was just a note about his family and wanting to eat a peanut butter sandwich.
That's weird.
For sure. Over the years, more than 10,000 bones or bone fragments have been located on Fox Hollow Farms.
Jesus.
Yeah. By 1999, only 8 missing people had been identified from the remains on the property. In April of 1999, Herb was listed as the primary suspect in the I-70 strangler cases, but the cases technically remain unsolved. But those, the I-70 strangler bodies stopped turning up around the same time that Herb bought Fox Hollow Farm.
Yeah, that seems a little on the nose.
Yeah. The case has appeared in the news again, like I said, both local news, but also with this docuseries on Hulu. The coroner for that county is making efforts to identify the bones found on the farm, and he's requesting family of the men who went missing in the 80s and early 90s to submit to DNA for testing. They're trying to use like the familial genealogy capabilities now to try and identify some of the unidentified remains. Since the renewed testing started, they have been able to identify a couple more victims. Guesstimates to the number of actual victims that could have been on the farm could be over 24.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. They have 10,000. They still are finding bones on that property.
That's crazy.
Some investigators also believe that Herb may not have been acting alone. They question how one man could have moved so many bodies over 200 yards to the woods behind his house without help from anyone else. Because they think his picture, he looks very small. But, I mean, he's not a big, strong-looking guy. He's just a puny little-looking guy. They think a lot of the deaths probably happened in the pool area, and he would have to drag a dead body over 200 yards into the woods. And they were like, I don't think he could do that. So they think that he had help. However, there were a lot of bullets and shotgun shells also found in the woods. So they think, as well as like rope and handcuffs, they think that maybe he had tied people up and walked them into the woods and killed them in the woods, which could explain why, how he could get so many people back there because he's walking them out there. But I don't know. Once Herb died, the investigators just stopped looking at other possibilities. And they actually kind of closed it out and they were like, we don't need to identify anybody anymore. We're done. But now the new coroner is like, no, we need to get some answers for families of missing people. So in respect for the identified victims, here is a list. Johnny Bayer, Jeff Jones, Richard Douglas Hamilton Jr., Alan Lee Livingston, Stephen Sperling Hale, Alan Wayne Broussard, Roger Allen Goodlett, Michael Frederick Mike Kern, and Manuel Resendez. Now, in the new docuseries, because I watched a couple, I watched an old one from Investigation Discovery, and then I watched the new docuseries, and the old one was in there in little snippets, but they've got some new people looking at some of the information, and Mark Goodyear, the guy who came forward and said this weird, shady thing happened, he's now changing his story a little bit because he said initially it was just the one encounter, and now decades later, he's saying that he was actually in a relationship with Herb off and on for a couple of years. He's changing his story about how he was stalked by Herb, and then he stalked Herb, and it was just super weird. It was super weird. So some seasoned investigators are looking at it and going, I think this guy was involved, or at least he knows more than he's telling us. And why didn't he have this information back then? And why has his story changed? And then they also found somebody who claimed to have been out at the house when Mark Goodyear was there and somebody else was killed and shot, but nothing ever was followed up by that statement. So I don't know. It's really weird. I'm not saying anybody was involved. Who knows at this point? But it's definitely a question that is coming up with the docuseries and people looking into the case further, because once Herb was found dead, they were like, all right, we're done.
That's kind of sad for the victims' families.
For sure, especially if there's 22 dozen people still unidentified out there.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even include the dozen I-70 strangler cases that they think he was responsible for. So, yeah. So that's my lesser known evil serial killer story.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that guy before.
Right. And a lot of people think that that's because it never went to trial, because
he died
before.
Interesting.
Yep. Oh, and another weird thing was the day before he died, police had stopped him and said, you can't be sleeping in this public park. And they noticed in the back of his car, there were boxes full of VHS videotapes. And when they found his deceased body, there were no tapes in his car. So what happened to the tapes?
It was in the 80s. I might be involved in the book that I'm reading, because that's only 8 hours away from Omaha.
Okay. Could be.
I don't know. There's a lot of people implicated. That whole thing had the clown serial killer implicated, Gacy.
Oh, yeah. Which we haven't done, but we should do.
We should do. There I need to do some more bizarre research on it, though, because he might be linked to some. We might be able to do a 2-for-1.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, do you have a chaser for us?
I do. I have a watch recommendation for you guys today.
Perfect.
And that is White Lotus Season 3 is out. Well, the first episode is out.
I know. And we are purposefully not watching it because we want to binge several episodes together.
Yeah, it's got Billy Bob Thornton in it.
Does it really?
Not Billy Bob. No. Sorry, no. Walton Goggins.
Walton Goggins. Big difference.
Mixed up. Yeah, I get them mixed up. But yeah, it's got Walton Goggins in it. And it's the second episode comes out tonight. So I don't.
Okay.
I think it comes out at like 10 tonight. So I think I'm going to have to watch it tomorrow. But
all right.
Season one's or episode one is decent. So okay. Far.
Cool.
It's got the That's whole exciting. Weird, like, White Lotus vibe. Like, I didn't
of course
like
it does.
Season Perfect. 2 very much, but I love season 1.
But I liked them both.
Kind of like you got to figure out like what's going on because everyone's acting a little weird.
Yeah. I love it.
What is your chaser?
My chaser is also a watch recommendation, and that is for the movie The Gorge on Apple.
Okay.
So it is about these two highly trained snipers, one on one side of this gorge and one on the other, and they are hired to observe the gorge for weird happenings and evil things that are living in the gorge and gonna come out of the gorge.
Okay.
And I started watching it because I thought it was a show. We started watching it, had absolutely no concept of what it was, and got totally sucked in. It's really good. Highly recommend it. There's conspiracies, there's evil, gross creatures that want to murder everything. It's really, really good. I even asked your dad, I was like, how do you describe this movie? Like, what is it? And he's like, I don't even know. I don't know. It's good though. It's really good. There's creepy stuff.
What's it called again?
The Gorge.
The Gorge. Okay.
Yeah. I think you'll really like it.
What's it on?
Apple.
Apple. Okay. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Make sure to rate us on Apple. Give us a thumbs up, a follow, a share. Yeah.
Share with all of your friends. We love making new friends because our current friends shared us. So... Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for checking us out. Love you, Mom.
Love you, bud.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.